Last summer, Stetson and I were down on the shores of Lake McIntosh, waiting for the wind to blow. We have discovered that if we have too much wind, if we simply unload our sailboards and take them down to the shore, it stops. And we think that may be, although we can't prove it, how Jesus calmed the storm, but we're not sure. But anyway, we're sitting on the shore of the lake and talking to this guy who had quite a story to tell, because he said that he had almost become a spy for the CIA. Kind of interesting. And I said, well, tell me more about it. You know, and he said, well, he was recruited along with a few hundred people by the CIA, and they got them all together, and they started to test them. And they gave them psychological testing and intellectual testing and language testing and emotional testing and physical testing, and immediately washed the larger portion of them out. They sent most of them home just about the first week or so, and whittled the group down to about a third of what it was. And then they increased the challenge of the tests and went back through the tests, only this time the bar was raised even higher. And went through the round of tests, and they got it down to maybe a dozen, and then they got it even harder. And they finally narrowed the group down to about four people, and he was one of the four, and they sent those four into a foreign country field to train them in spycraft. And that training lasted for about a year. Now, this is my shady memory of these things, and I can't even remember what I had for breakfast this morning, so... rest assured that these are not the exact details of this story, and if they were, then we'd have to shoot you. So, you know, it's all top secret. But it lasted about a year. And at the end of the year, they had learned all this spycraft, and I got all excited hearing this, and I wanted to show them how much I knew about spycraft. So I started to ask, well, did they tell you how to lose a tail? If you're being tailed by somebody... did they tell you how to do it? I was going to say shake a tail, but I didn't want you to get the wrong idea. But and he said, no, as a matter of fact, the CIA instructs us to never attempt to shake a tail, because once you have been spotted, that's it. You'll be pulled out of the field and somebody else will replace you, and you'll go to someplace else where you're not spotted. And so you don't do anything about a tail. And so he went on and on and told me about this. And then the last part of his training was another round of tests. And now the bar was even higher. And in his case, he washed out at this point because of the final examination revealed that he was too much of a risk taker and would not be safe as a spy, because he would, if he, you know, given the choice, he would take a risk. And so the CIA sent him home. But he had a fascinating year and a half of experiences, and we enjoyed talking to him. But as we've been studying through the teaching that Jesus Christ has been doing about being the bread of life and what the implications of that are, we recognize that he's been doing a very similar thing to what the CIA did with that group of recruits. Jesus started with this huge congregation. I mean, he assembled an enormous congregation. It would dwarf the largest churches in this country. He had over 20,000 people at his overnight retreat. He took them across the lake, or they followed him across the lake, and he fed them over there. But he had this number of people because he was ministering to their felt needs. He was healing the sick and feeding the hungry and so forth. And if he had gone to any church growth seminar, he would have realized that he was on the right track, and he should have stayed doing that, ministering to what the people felt like they needed. But Jesus had sadly not gone to any of those seminars, and he hadn't ordered the CDs and tapes and stuff, the notebooks. And so he did something very different from that. He started to become more and more clear about what he really meant. And so when the people came to him and asked for bread, he said, look, you're chasing the wrong kind of bread. There's a kind of bread that you can consume that will live in your heart forever and produce God's eternal life inside you. Well, once the people, you know, some of the people realized that, hey, he's going to start preaching to us now and he's not going to give us any more bread, we're out of here. And so a group hived off and went. And the rest of them said, well, how do we get this bread? What work can we do so we can have it? And Jesus said to him, you can't work for it. It's God's work. And the work is that you would believe, but God does that. And some of them got confused and left. Well, how do we get to this bread? How can you give us this bread? And he said, you don't have the bread given to you. You must be given to the bread. God must draw you to himself and then give you to me because I am the bread of life, he said. Well, that didn't fit some people's notions of how this is supposed to work, and they left, went on home. And then Jesus ramped it up even farther. He says, it's not just enough that God, through the process of you listening to him and learning from him, draws you to himself and gives you to me. You must eat my flesh and drink my blood. Well, you know, that's offensive enough for our ear, for the Jewish ear. It was absolutely offensive. And of course, he was using a metaphor for the kind of belief that is similar to swallowing, in which you it's a personal act of trust in which you take something from the outside and incorporate it inside to become your life. And nevertheless, the way he phrased this, my flesh is real food, my blood is real drink, and you must chow down, the way Gil put it, on my flesh daily. You must feast on me, the way somebody else put it. If you want this eternal life, you swallow, then you come to me and recognize that I am your source of nourishment forever. And way too hard. And now he's down to a group of maybe, a few dozen people. And these are the hardcore. These are the ones who consider themselves to be disciples. These are the ones, because they are disciples, have necessarily left family and home situations behind. They've quit their jobs. They've walked away. And they've followed Jesus. They've made a radical commitment to following Jesus. And at this point, he's ramped up the level of challenge, of threat, of radicalness in his teaching. He's become so clear about what he's talking about that they say in verse 60, this is hard. This is a hard teaching. Who can accept this? Now notice, it's the disciples that are left at this point. See that? Aware that his disciples were grumbling about this, Jesus said to them, does this offend you? What if you see the Son of Man ascend to where he was before? The Spirit gives life. The flesh counts for nothing. The words I have spoken to you are spirit. They are life. Yet, there are some of you who do not believe. For Jesus had known from the beginning which of them did not believe and who would betray him. He went on to say, this is why I told you that no one can come to me unless the Father has enabled him. From this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. You do not want to leave too, do you? Jesus asked the 12. And Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. And then Jesus replied, have I not chosen you, the 12? Yet one of you is a devil. He meant Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, who, though one of the 12, was later to betray him. As Jesus draws the strings on this teaching of being the bread of life, this new kind of bread, he brings the level of radical threat, of offensiveness, up to such a great height that, even his disciples find it too much and say, this is not what I expected when I came. I'm not sure I can accept this. And Jesus goes back to them and keeps ramping this up until most of them leave. He starts out by saying, you think this is offensive? If you're offended by what you've heard me say, how do you think you're going to feel by what you see me do? Now, what he says is, what if you see me ascend to heaven? But Jesus is hinting at something that he knows is true, that the road to his ascension into heaven necessarily progresses through the cross. That the Messiah, the one that these guys have banked all their hopes on, is eventually going to be brutalized and murdered on a Roman cross. The most disgraceful and disgusting and offensive method of death in that day and perhaps ever. He says, you ain't seen nothing yet. If you think this is offensive, wait till you see how the application of this plays out. Absolutely offensive. And the many, perhaps most, of those who heard his words said, time to cut my losses, go home. And they no longer followed him. Now he's got the 12 left. And he ramps it up even further. Why is it, we ask, why is it that Jesus would be offensive? We sing a gentle Jesus, kind and good, you know, and every religion in the world, it seems like, owns Jesus in one way or another. Very few do not acknowledge Jesus as a wonderful prophet or man of God or whatever. And yet the word says that he was being offensive. In their face offensive and ramping it up to the point where he said, look, you ain't seen nothing. It's going to get worse. If you follow me, it's going to get worse. It's going to be tougher. Why? Because the people he was speaking to were stuck with their feet on the earth, deluded by the illusions of life on this earth. And so he says to them, look, the flesh counts for nothing. It's the spirit that gives life. You see, the people that were listening to Jesus in that crowd and then the dwindling crowd, the people were stuck with the idea that you measured the successfulness of life by how much money you had, where you live, what kind of a house, what clothes you wore, whether you could shop at L.L. Bean's or not, or, you know, how much stature or status you had in the community, whether or not you had any clout, whether you were happy, all these kinds of things. And Jesus said, look, that's all nonsense. That's nothing. It doesn't count for anything. Not even your lofty wisdom counts for anything. It's all flesh. It's the spirit that you need to be really alive. All this is just details. Do you know in Central Africa that AIDS has gone beyond epidemic proportions? You know, employers in Central Africa hire two guys when they need one because they know within a few months' time one of those guys will be dead of AIDS. Almost everybody suffering from AIDS in parts of Central Africa. And there is a deep-seated belief that is taught and spread around in the parts of that region that if a man has AIDS, if he has relations with a virgin girl, he will be cured. Can you imagine? Can you see why it's epidemic? Can you see the tragedy and the heartbreak? Now, if you're on a team to go there and fix that problem, what have you got to do? You've got to smash through that superstition. You've got to be offensive to it in order to be able to bring the truth. And Jesus comes to a bunch of people who are twisted and distorted and stuck and imprisoned by the fact that they think money is where it's at, or clothes is where it's at, or happiness is where it's at, or all this stuff is where it's at. And he says, no, it's nothing. What you need is a spirit. It's the only thing that matters. The doctors that went into impoverished countries decades ago to try and cure things like, you know, leprosy and malaria, and they brought the medicines. They had hypodermics loaded with the medicine, but they had to bust through the delusions of the culture, the medicine man delusions, in order to be able to get permission to actually inject what the people really needed. And Jesus was the same way. Why was he offensive? Because we're deluded. And it's not about flesh. And it's going to get worse if you follow Jesus. It's going to be tougher. Be persecuted, perhaps. He's going to be murdered. But you understand that flesh counts for nothing. It's the spirit that you need. And then he says, my words are spirit. My words give life. But some of you don't believe. Some of you have not swallowed. Right? This sentence highlights a very basic difference between the evangelical point of approach to Jesus and what is termed a mainline or liberal approach to Jesus. With Resurrection Day coming soon, it's about time for Time Magazine to publish an article on the Jesus Seminar. They seem to do it every year about this time. And the attitude of the Jesus Seminar, which is, as you know, a group of liberal theologians who have met together to decide what is authentic Jesus, what sayings of Jesus are authentic in the Word, and which ones you cannot trust, okay? And these guys have met together to judge according to their limited understanding and their stuck-on-earth ignorance. In their attitude, okay, well, we've got letters after our name. We're highly educated scholars. We have the right to judge whether or not this is an authentic saying of Jesus or not. And do you know that they have erased almost everything he said in the book of John? Because they've judged it by their own preconceived notions. For example, they said anything that has to do with a miracle will wipe that right out. Because there are no miracles. Says who? Says we. Okay? Anything that we can that resembles anything that anybody else ever said, well, we'll take that out. Why? Because we'll assume he was copying. Or the disciples were copying and made it up later. Well, Jesus said, in these words that they were, you know, were busily erasing, he said, "My words are spirit, but some of you have not swallowed them. And if you don't, you have no life in you." Now, at that point, most of the disciples split. They left. And it seems to me that when John says that Jesus knew already who was going to leave, he wasn't surprised by this. In fact, when he taught the parable of the sower, as it's recorded in Matthew, he said, you know, some of that seed is never going to be swallowed. It's going to bounce off the hard path. Some of it's going to be swallowed, and yet the cares of the persecution that comes on account of the word is going to cause people to fall away. And some of it is going to be swallowed and spring up, and it's going to seem okay, but then the deceitfulness of money and the worries of life choke it out. Well, these are the same three things. He says, you think my words offend you, wait till you see what following me is like. There's going to be persecution involved. He says the flesh counts for nothing. If you have the worries of life and the deceitfulness of money choking it, you know, with its hand around your throat, you're going to leave. And if you have not swallowed this word, you'll never find life. It's no big deal. He wasn't surprised. But he's ramping up and increasing the challenge until the people left. Exact opposite of what we're taught to do in church growth seminars. Oh. What does it take to follow Jesus? The one last question. One last question that he asked them. One last test. He said to the 12, do you want to leave? Or are you going to stay? See that? You want to leave? Or are you going to stay? And Peter tried to answer the question. He got it almost right. Got one word wrong. He said, Peter says, Lord, whom should we go? You have the words of eternal life. Way to go, Peter. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. But he got one word wrong. You know what it is? Huh? It's the word we. It's the word we. Because Jesus answers him and says, look, I picked all 12 of you, and one of you is not going to get it. This question that he asked is addressed to you. It's addressed to me. It's a question that must be answered with the word I. And he says, are you going to stay? Or will you leave? My teaching and my life and what it means to follow me will get more and more radical and tough. And there will be persecution involved. And it's upside down because everything you've been taught to believe and hold true and all your treasure and all this stuff, it's nothing. It's flesh. It's nothing. It's the Spirit. That's the only thing that matters. Going to stay? Going to leave? If you want to stay, you must swallow my words. Personal decision to receive, accept, take from the outside, inside. And he said, if you do that, I will live in you forever, and I will give you eternal life. One last question. Jesus says, I'm the bread of life. You must swallow me. Are you going to stay? Or do you want to go home?